Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. And we come your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com. We archive the programs at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. The podcasts are also available at SoundCloud. You can now actually get to the SoundCloud podcasts, not only through iTunes, but also through Facebook. There is a link on the Richard Dugan TMYS page. That's at Facebook. You can then listen to all of our interviews from 2018. We're working slowly, but working on getting the interviews for 2017 and the time previous. All of those interviews going back earlier than January 1, 2018. Those are still available at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. So please go there. We'd also like to hear from you. The email address, TMYS, for Tell Me Your Story, at richarddugan.com. TMYS at richarddugan.com. We're on Twitter as well, and we encourage you to check all that out, as well as I have already stated, the Facebook page is Richard Dugan TMYS. So please check it out. I think you're going to enjoy what you find. And if you don't, I want to know about why. I would love to hear from you. Today is going to be an extraordinary program, not like any other program isn't. We are always having great programs. But today in particular, because we're going to be focusing on the job you do. I've said it many, many times on this program. I am very grateful for my father's advice over the years. Of course, when he gave it to me, I wasn't real thrilled with it, but it's not usually the way. One of the sayings that he gave me was, eat, drink, and be merry in moderation, because nobody gets out of this world alive. Beats the end of that thing that normally says, for tomorrow you die. But then he also said to me, and make sure you find a job you love doing, because you're going to be doing it for a long time. Don't get stuck like me. Now, maybe for a short period of time, my dad, he was stuck. But then he went back to school in the 70s to a junior college, took computer programming courses with the pinhole computer cards and fanfold paper. And he's still working on his computer to this day in his late 80s. And it's very exciting to be a part of that as well. Actually, the last time I was there, we had a little tutorial on the editing software. And I had a grand time teaching, and he had a great time picking up some new tips. So, but that's what we're going to be talking about today is work that matters. And we're asking you to create a livelihood that reflects your core intention. Maya Duryea is our guest. She is the author of this book and a lot of other cool stuff that I've been looking at. And I've really been looking forward to this interview. Maya, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thank you so much for inviting me, Richard. I'm looking forward to this.
This is really cool because, you have so many neat things up on your website, which we'll be giving folks here in just a moment. Obviously, with this particular book, it's right up our alley because we're always looking to assist people because, to me, this falls under this category. I mean, you titled the book Work That Matters. And, of course, I'm sure we've all heard the phrase, if you're doing what you really love, you never work a day in your life.
Right.
And
yeah.
We're also talking too. We also talk on this program about finding one's life's purpose. And mm-hmm. A lot of folks feel that the two sometimes are mutually exclusive. There's no way I can make enough money to support myself doing my life's purpose because there's no money in it, whatever it might be, if one finds mm-hmm. that. Sometimes right. I feel that way, even with what I've been doing for the last 40 years, and I do believe I've been one of the lucky ones who found what I love doing very early on, at the age of 19. Although I did love delivering newspapers as a paper boy during high school. That was a great time, too. But there were some similarities there, interestingly enough. So let's mm-hmm. talk about the difference, if there is one, from your perspective, Maya, between one's life's purpose and work.
Wow, that's an interesting question. Actually, I mean, to me, they're pretty aligned, although I think in everyday reality for most of us, that's not the case, which is why there's a lot of suffering that comes from our work. But one of the things I try to do in the book is actually widen our definition of what work can be. And I know that's the very first word of the title, work. But if you notice the subtitle, it's actually, I use the word livelihood, which I like a lot better than work. So to me, livelihood really kind of opens that up. And it may actually not be something we necessarily get paid for doing, or at least it's not our full-time payment job. But it becomes a way that we can express, and the phrase that I use is express our core intention. So that would be kind of similar to what you're saying is a purpose. So, and I'll just tell you a little bit of a story. There's a couple stories about the genesis of this book and why it, you know, this topic is so important to me. But I'm actually going to lead with one that's a little bit more recent in my life. And about, I guess it was about 20 years ago, I was lucky enough to spend some time in Bali, on the island of Bali in Indonesia, when I was in my 30s. And I actually spent about a month there in a little village. And every day I would watch the flow of life there. I would sit on my porch and just kind of see, you know, what unfolded in front of me. And it was so fascinating to me because every day I would watch as women came out, and for some reason, it was almost always women who were doing the work in that society. But they would go out every day and they would work in the fields, they would work on the roads. But the fascinating thing to me was that as they were doing that, they had their kids with them, their friends were there. They might stop in the middle of the day and do like a religious ceremony, what's called a puja there, and they would also be laughing. So it was just like this kind of very fascinating flow of, you know, there was no separation between their work, their family, their worship, their playtime and leisure. It all kind of flowed together really seamlessly. And it made me realize, you know, when I came back to the States, how much we segregate those things. We think, oh, no, this is over here. Like, you know, I can't be doing this when I'm working. So I feel like that's a piece of this puzzle as well. It's just loosening up our idea about what work is and just trying to kind of pull in different ways to be present in our work that are not so separate from the rest of our life.
Well, and of course, a lot of businesses, corporations in particular, they don't want you doing other stuff. They want you focused on what they're paying you to do. People get into a lot of trouble spending time on Facebook while they're sitting at their desk if they have a computer terminal, all those kinds of things. And it's like, well, no, wait a minute. I'm paying you whatever it is they're paying you, even if it's minimum wage. I'm paying you to do your job and, you know, and not fuss around and do this and do that and do the other thing. And then there are those other workplaces where... And I was very fortunate many years ago, and in one sense still am very fortunate. The philosophy, though it's not official where I'm working now, but at one station that I worked at, they did not want me to work 8 hours a day. They wanted me to work until the work was done. What was the point of hanging around another 2-3 hours? And it was not that I would then rush through. It was had that never entered my mind to rush through to get out early.
Right.
But it was like they I wasn't on a time clock. Of course, the other thing, too, is I always hated hourly. So I've always asked for salary. Now, some say, well, gee, you're cheating yourself because if they work you more than 40 hours a week, then you get overtime. So, well, yeah, but then you got to deal. I just didn't want to deal with the time cards. I just find that reprehensible, in my opinion, obnoxious.
I'm with you absolutely on that one. I hate that concept of like working for hours and time.
Another thing, too, is that when we are going through grade school and high school or preparing for post-secondary, we're working our way through all of this, we're always being asked, and sometimes even at a very early age, 4, 5, 6 years of age, so what do you want to do when you grow up? What do you want to be when you grow up? And of course, obviously, little kids, a fireman, a policeman, you know, those kinds of things, right? A cowboy. There was a great PSA that was out a few years ago. And it would start out showing these boys, and of course, this was a little stereotypical at the time, playing in the dirt with their Tonka trucks. And I did that when I was a kid and so forth and having all this fun. Next scene cuts to adults, guys wearing hard hats, working on a construction site. Then the next scene, the third scene, was a little girl, and she was playing with her dolls and doing a little medical procedure, if you will, bandaging up her doll's arm kind of thing. And then the next scene, the fourth scene, is There she is in the ER taking care of people. And I thought,
nothing like a little gender stereotyping, huh?
Granted, okay, but at the same time, if we were to go back, what I saw was, if we were to go back to our childhoods and find those things that we loved doing, I'll bet you there is a job that we could do as adults, setting the stereotypes aside, that we could certainly thrive on, and our livelihoods could be, brought forth, so to speak. What do you think about that theory?
Yes, I would agree with that, and I would add another element to it, which I think is really important, and it's one of the places where the book really tries to focus. It's not only the what we love to do, but underneath that, it's why we love to do it, and that gets at that core intention. Because I think it's really easy to, and our society does it all the time, just like you pointed out. I mean, when you go to a party or when you meet somebody, usually the first thing people ask you is, what do you do for a living? What's your job? So it's always the what. But what I'm suggesting is that underneath that, there is a why, which is actually even more important. And when you connect with that why, it gives you a lot more flexibility about how you do your work in the world. And it doesn't rely on a certain job description. You can actually carry that why into a number of different settings, some of which may completely surprise you. And that's kind of a way, especially in our world today, where, we're in an economically challenged world, and sometimes we do have to take what's right in front of us for work. So even if it's not your ideal thing that you've thought of, the more you're connected with that core intention, with your purpose, the more you can emphasize that in almost any job that you have and find more fulfillment in it.
One of the phrases one of the words that I've always tried to foster, so to speak, is the whole aspect of thriving. The phrase surviving has been used quite often, and all we do is we struggle. We're consumer producers, and we're working for the machine, as it were, or the man, whatever you mm-hmm. want to call it. And we really, you look at other countries around the world, Europe in particular, what do they get? A month off in vacation, and they take it. As a matter of fact, I think they have to. The company's not going to let them just work on through. Sorry, but you got to go. And your job is going to be here when you get back. But in this country, it's almost a sign of weakness to step away. But if you're able to find something that you really love doing, and obviously, hopefully, you do it well, so much the better. Now, let me ask you something. Now, you've got a 10-year period here from 2008. And when I read about that, I thought, interesting, right around the time of the economic downturn. That's what I'm going to call it, the downturn. I don't know what, I don't know if it was a recession, a depression, a concave, convex. I don't know what the heck it was. I know is that a lot of people lost their jobs. And one of the thoughts that came to my mind, and this is going more metaphysical, going a little metaphysical on you here. When I heard about the hundreds of thousands of people who lost their jobs in that 2-3 year period and beyond, the first thing that came to my mind was, I wonder how many of those people hated their jobs, that it was the job that my father, mother did, and her mother, father, and her mother. In other words, it was generational. This was what we did as a, as a family. And that my understanding is statistics showed following the downturn that there were more new entrepreneurial ventures started around that period of time than had ever been started in decades. Mm-hmm. Because people now had the opportunity to go after what they really wanted to do. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I do think there's a lot of truth to that. And that period, which is also, I share some of my story in the book, that was a huge upheaval for me as well. Same thing happened. I had worked at a small nonprofit in the San Francisco Bay Area, and right before the economic whatever we'll call it was laid off, and that was completely unexpected to me. And then as I tried to send out resumes and apply for other jobs, heard nothing back, and then the economy went kapooey. So it was. It opened up this opportunity for me, and it was a forced opportunity. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to plan to do this. But it was like, okay, well, now I have to do something to make money. What's it going to be? And I think a lot of other people went through the same thing. So it's kind of like this, you know, invitation from the universe, like, okay, you know, what you have been doing, it's not there anymore. So here's an opportunity to be really creative with your livelihood and go for it.
Well, I know that I would encourage people to do just that. It's one of those things that that is just quite extraordinary in that when you do lock into it, you know it. I've been fortunate. I've had the feeling most of my life that I have been in the right place at the right time. And I don't know of too many people who feel that way about being anywhere for that matter. they just struggle through. And let's talk a little bit about some of that as far as this whole process of searching for that which would help one to create a livelihood that reflects your core intention. So there are several things we need to touch upon in the rest of the program here. We've sort of already sort of defined work, and I think we've touched upon, you know, work that matters, that makes a difference. But we certainly will be going into that later. But you're talking about the subtitle actually speaks adds more questions. Create a livelihood. How does one begin that process of creating? I mean, again, going back to the stereotype of my dad worked at the same job for 20, 30, 40 years, and then he retired, got his pension, his gold watch, and died at the age of 92. You know, that was his livelihood. And there are people who are saying, I want more than that. So how do we create that in this context of the work that we create that matters?
Right. Well, to say something about the, what I offer in the book, the process that I offer in the book, and the framework I use is something called the six keys to liberation-based livelihood. And they're basically six qualities that, and believe me, all of this is based on my own lived experience and a lot of trial and error, and coming through the other end and realizing like, oh, okay, this is, you know, it's the book that I wish I had when I was, you know, in my 20s and 30s. I think it would have helped me a lot just to understand, like, this is what I'm entering into, and this is how to navigate this territory. So the whole premise of the book is actually that, and I think I used this phrase at the very beginning, it's actually an inside job. You know, so I feel like in my search for work that I loved in my 20s and 30s and even into my 40s, you know, I tried out a lot of jobs. I had about five different careers. And I also did things that were pretty conventional. You know, I went to a career counselor. I read books like What Color Is Your Parachute? Took aptitude tests. So I was, you know, doing things that you're supposed to do when you're looking for work that you'd love, but it helped a little bit, right? But it wasn't clicking. Something just was not dialing in on a deeper level. So the premise of this book that I'm putting out into the world is that there is actually, like, I think an internal process that has to go along with all the other, you know, the skills that you develop and the aptitude tests that you might take. There are ways that you need to actually, like, develop these six, I call them the six keys, these six qualities, and strengthen them in order to make it possible to create work that you love. So that's kind of fundamental to the book. It's, you know, there's a way in which it's asking you to get to know yourself better, to have, you know, the phrase I use is a contemplative practice of some kind. That doesn't necessarily mean sitting meditation, but just a way that you have to actually understand how you operate in the world and the way that you look at things, because that's key. And, you know, you're talking before about, like, people who struggle, and certainly I've been in that category. But we need to get better at understanding what that struggle is about so we can extract ourselves from that struggle. And so the six keys in the book and all the exercises and practices that go with them are a way for people, you know, if this speaks to them, to actually begin to work on that level so that, you know, on our internal level, we can kind of clean up some of the mess that we have inherited, you know, from our society, from our family conditioning, and just our own kind of patterns, and really sort of clear the path so that we can create work that we love. Mm-hmm. So that to me is just like, I think I want to kind of phrase that in a fundamental way and just say that's where the book is coming from. So it's actually, and I often say this when I do book readings, it's not the kind of book that's going to work for everybody, because for some people that's just, they're not into that, and that's totally fine. But if you're somebody who is curious about yourself and about, you know, how you can actually transform some of these old patterns, that to me is like the very first step towards creating work that you love.
We're talking with Maya Durr, and she has written a book called Work That Matters. What's the website that you would send people to get further information?
Well, you can visit my website, which is the same as my name, www.mayadurr.com. And then the book itself is available on Amazon. Also, it's on Barnes & Noble, and it would be in your bookstores. Or if it's not, you can always ask for them to carry it.
And before we jump into our break here, is your book yet available on Audible?
It's not on Audible. It is a Kindle. There's a Kindle version of it, but it's not on Audible yet.
Okay. We're going to continue our conversation here with Maya Durr, and we're going to continue talking about this whole aspect of finding the job that's right for you, the work that matters. I have to say, before we break, I did actually take an aptitude test at the age of... I think it was 18 or 19. Maybe I was still in high school. And it was actually an aptitude test that they gave me at the blind center. I was legally blind from birth and so forth and so on. I'll tell you that story later. And they gave me this aptitude test, and I took it. And this was actually before I had actually gotten into radio. And the aptitude test came out farmer. And I thought, really? Well, when we get back, I'll explain to you how that has all unfolded over the last, 30 or 40 years. We'll be back here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay tuned.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. As we said before, we're giving you choices, lots of different choices. We certainly hope you take advantage of them. We lay out this smorgasbord, and we want you to partake of anything and everything that resonates with you, and I certainly hope that this does as well. We're talking with Maya Durr, and she is the author of Work That Matters, Create a Livelihood That Reflects Your Core Intention. And Maya, thank you so much for staying with us here on the program. You had an experience that was, as I like to use the term, was the catalyst that propelled you forward into, ostensibly, this interview that we're doing now. You are here now because of the work that you did back in 2008. That wasn't your intention. But nonetheless, what was it that 10 years ago said, I got to do something different. This isn't working for me.
Right. Well, actually, it was like we were talking about before the break. It was actually not a choice. So I was working at a small nonprofit in the Bay Area and received a layoff notice. So I actually really loved that job. It was one of the jobs I loved the most, but it was definitely a message from the universe like, okay, you know, this is over and it's time to move on. And even before this, you know, I had a number of jobs and really had begun already this process that I share in the book of just trying to understand, like, how can I align myself more with my core intention? But that kind of catapulted me into a whole new dimension, which really offered me the chance to say, okay, nothing else is working here. I'm not getting any responses back from my resumes. So this is time to actually put my flag in the ground and start my own business. And that's where we're at today. So I've been, for the past 10 years, I've been a consultant, been doing coaching with people, and have written this book.
Well, now, you could have gone out and worked for another employer. You could have found another job. I thought that, too, back in 2006. 2006, when I lost my job due to the fact that the new owners of the radio station were changing the format, but they weren't keeping anybody. They were letting everybody go. And could have stayed in Phoenix and probably found another radio job and still be there to this day. But the wife and I decided that, hey, it's time to make a change. And we had two choices. One was Ireland. Unfortunately, we didn't have quite the resources to do a week's worth of R&R, relax and recreate, and then reconnaissance work, so to speak, for work. So we chose her hometown of Santa Barbara, and that's how we wound up here.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, too, and this is a factor I'd like to talk about. I remember the fact that I had lost jobs before. And a lot of times when that would happen, I became extremely fearful of survival.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But not this time. I had absolutely no fear. There was something inside of me that said, you're going to be okay. No big deal. Just relax, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we came here for a week, went back, put the house up for sale. And quite honestly, it sold quite literally 2 weeks. We closed 2 weeks before the Phoenix market fell through.
Wow.
I mean, you talk about timing. Mm-hmm. What about that in terms of, I mean, you said, you know, in a way you didn't really have a choice, but, you know, I'm a firm believer that I don't care what situation you're in, you always have choices. It's just how long are you willing to look for those other possibilities. But what about this aspect of fear in regards to, you know, stepping outside of, shall we say, stepping outside the box or the nine dots to maybe, again, like my theory of the thousands of people who lost their jobs in 2008 and 2009, maybe now is the time for you to pursue that art or music or, again, whatever it is. I've got a widget that beats all widgets kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I think actually we may be saying the same thing, just in slightly different ways. But, you know, when I'm talking about not having a choice, I meant in that particular moment, like, you know, really there was nothing coming back at me.
Yeah.
There were no responses to anything. However, you know, and I think this is where we are in the same wavelength, like I always had a choice about how to respond to that situation, right?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe the conditions of the world were things I didn't have a choice about that were coming towards me, but how I chose to respond to them. And then, you know, you bring up fear, which is a really interesting energy, and that's actually one of the keys. So in the six keys to liberation-based livelihood, the fourth key, I call it to make friends with uncertainty, because so often when we enter these new territories, you know, either of our own choice or not, you know, what comes up for a lot of us is like, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? You know, what's going to happen if I move on from this job that I really don't like, but, you know, at least I know where my paycheck is coming from. There's structure to it. You know, to go beyond that, we're entering the land of uncertainty. And uncertainty for most of us brings up a lot of anxiety and even fear. And so the way I've learned to work with that and what that key in the book is about is really about beginning to understand fear as, you know, if we back it up before we put all our stories into it, it's really just an energy, you know. So sure, it's like when we go into unknown territory, this is our old primal instincts, right? There's fight or there's flight.
Mm-hmm.
So that's there. Those energies are there. But what we can do is we can learn how to actually surf on the waves of those energies. So before it turns into full-fledged fear and we get paralyzed, you know, it's actually something else. And there's an excitement that's there as well. So the more that we're able to kind of tune into that energy field and, you know, step over into the excitement zone and not let it tip into fear, we get much more empowered about how we go into that situation.
Yeah. Your website, which, of course, is mayadur.com, and it is mayadurr.com. We will be linked to it as well. You have these 10 principles, if you will. And I was reading through those, pardon me, and there was one that this is in our conversation here, and I would love for you to expound on this because I've always had a problem with this theory.
Uh-huh.
And it is epitomized by a scene in, and of course I'm constantly using Star Trek references. This one's from The Next Generation, and of course Scotty from the original series shows up as an old man, but he still has the engineering gene, if you will, or spark. And he's talking to LaForge, and LaForge is asked by the captain through the comm, hey, how long is it going to take for you to get us up and running again? Whatever the thing was he was looking for to get running again. And he says, take 2 hours. Okay, let me know when you've got it done. And So then Scotty says, you know, if you want to have them think of you as a miracle worker, you've got to tell them it's going to take a lot longer than it really is, so that when it takes less time, then you are you're thought of as a miracle worker.
Right.
And I thought, well, that seems awfully disingenuous. Why can't you just be honest? And if that's how long it takes, and if it takes longer, then you go to them. Looks like we've run into a little snag, and it's going to take a little bit longer than blah, blah. But because to me, that just seems like dishonest communication with the people that you're dealing with. Can you talk to, because I can't remember the name of the, I don't have that in front of me at this very moment, but I know you know which one it is, about under promise and over produce
right.
or something
like
that.
Over deliver.
Talk to me about that in reference to the my query.
Yeah, well, it's interesting. I mean, I totally hear your point about wanting to have honest communication, and I'm all for that. I think, you know, and that under-promise, over-deliver, that's actually, I mean, I feel like I draw on that all the time in my consulting practice, because I notice my tendency is actually the other way around. Like, I want to over-promise something to a client at the very start, and then it gets really difficult when I realize, like, oh my gosh, like, I need more time to do this. So I've just noticed that tendency in myself. And this might happen more with women than men because we're conditioned this way, right? We want to please. There's that sense of like, oh, yes, I'll do anything for you. So just noticing that in myself, it's become important over the years in my, and especially I think in my, you know, initial conversations with clients, to just realize like I need to be careful of that. Like, you know, if I think I can get this report done for this client in 3 weeks, I should actually probably let them know, allow me a whole month to do this. And then if I get it done in 3 weeks, hey, I have over-delivered what I've said to them. Mm-hmm. But that way I kind of protect the relationship from getting into a place where it's like, oops, you know, I need a longer amount of time. So I've not ever really thought about it the way you're saying, but I feel like I still am communicating honestly with them. I'm just noticing my tendency and how that can kind of set up a problem in a relationship. So I'm just really trying to watch that.
I can see the principle that you're talking about, because if in fact, as we all know, it happens to us all the time, that, you know, we're in the middle of a project. I mean, I get this. I had a situation with my boss just recently, where he asked me to provide him with something, a digital format of something. I said, sure, no problem. And it wasn't, but I forgot about it. I didn't write it down. Mm-hmm. I didn't put it in my calendar. So he comes to me about 2 days later. He says, how soon before you can get that to me? And I said, oh, hang on. And I immediately jumped on it and I got it to him within the next 5 minutes, which is a little different scenario, granted. But it's one of those, there's a process that I have developed over the years that has helped me to accomplish tasks in a timely manner. And it's especially if someone's made a request via email. That email stays in my inbox until the job is completed and I reply either the file's on its way or the thing is done or, you know, whatever it is, to tell them, hey, we're finished. You know, I'm finished. And then the email gets deleted. And until that's done, it stays in that box. And my box can get pretty darn full if I'm not careful.
mm-hmm.
But this is very interesting. And so this is I'm trying to remember. Exactly. Now you have a lot of different things that are available to you. I also want to talk about the Liberated Life Project. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, that was one of my early. So in these past 10 years that I've had my own business and been self-employed, I mean, the thing that you learn pretty quickly when you're self-employed is you need to, like, really be creative on how you bring in money, right? Because one stream of revenue doesn't always do it. So early on in that 10-year period, I was really experimenting with, okay, you know, I'm doing this. I'm consulting with clients around nonprofit work. But let me start another stream here. And so I can't remember when it was, maybe around 2010. And I was actually inspired by a man who you might have heard of named Chris Guillebeau. Chris has a website called The Art of Nonconformity. And so he was a big influence on me early on, and just reading his writings and the way he did his business, that inspired me to like actually create a blog, which I call the Liberated Life Project. And, you know, that was the place for me to channel all my creative energy. So, you know, while I had the consulting going, which was a little bit more, you know, straight-laced organizational consulting, on the Liberated Life Project, I really got to just write about, you know, to me, it's like freedom is an essential value, and freedom in the way I do my work, the way other people do work, freedom to be an engaged citizen in the world. So all those topics I wrote about in the Liberated Life Project, and it's still on my website to this day, so all the archives are there.
You also talk about, on your website, about your five noble truths, and one of them you sort of touched upon. We'll dive into it. And pun intended. The first one is freedom is an inside job.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about that.
Yeah, well, I think so often, you know, we think that our happiness depends on external conditions. And really, and I think this is, I get this a lot from my, I'll just come out as a Buddhist here, you know, so from having a long time meditation practice and studying Buddhism, really what, you know, the main teaching is that it is possible to liberate ourselves from suffering. And we do that by the way we, you know, relate to the world. So it's not anything on the outside. It's really how we respond to the conditions that we need to move through. So that's where that phrase comes from. Freedom is an inside job. Just really encouraging people to, you know, look at what's going on inside of you. And like I explained before, the whole premise of the book is based on that as well. So it's not that outside conditions don't mean anything, because obviously they do, and I don't want to dismiss, you know, that there are real struggles in the world, and, you know, especially when we need to pay our bills and we have a family to take care of, we need to really recognize that. But we have so many more choices than we think we have about how we actually respond to that. We don't have to just react. We can actually creatively respond and create something new.
Well, and again, I've been touting that as I've been working on my book for the last 17 years.
It's not a big your book coming out, Richard.
Yeah, yeah. I'm working on it. Don't push. Don't pressure. But I will say that it's all about choices. It really is. And the first step in what I talk about is the first thing you have to do is make a choice. Well, part of the problem is that most of the time we don't know what choices are available to us. And
right,
that's the worst.
We've got such a limited perspective on that. Yeah.
We've got a limited perspective, and a lot of times, and this is where I get on my horse about education, this is where a lack of education is the greatest detriment, in my opinion, to a person's ability to make choices. I use the analogy of day in and day out. You do this every day. there's this heavy fog that's always around when you leave the house. So what you're told is you look down and you can see the white painted line on the shoulder of the road. You follow that and it'll take you to your destination, which it always does every single time.
Mm-hmm.
Then one day the fog lifts and you look out in front of you and you see a fork in the road that you didn't know was there. What are you going to do? You don't know where that fork goes. You don't know which, you know, you see the white line and you see where it goes. Let's just say, you know, off to one side, say off to the right. But gee, there's a fork off to the left. You know, I could risk going that way just to see what's there, because I can always walk back. But until that fog lifts, you don't know. You have no clue.
Right.
And that's what I'm talking about. And to me, education is the prime factor that allows us to know that we have other choices other than what our fathers have done, what our mothers have done, what our other siblings have done, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Talk to us a little bit about your perspective about education. And I know it doesn't have to be formal either.
Right. And I think it's important to me to talk about what that education looks like and feels like.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think in our world, unfortunately, you know, education has come to mean in mainstream schools, it's really just like conformity, actually. So it's, you know, teaching kids how to conform to certain ideas about our society and make sure they show up for work on time and, you know, have a sort of basic set of rules by which they behave by. So it's not very emancipatory education, you know. So I feel like there's really what's needed is not just education, but education that teaches us critical thinking. So how to really question, you know, question our own assumptions, question the assumptions of the society that we live in, and something called transformative learning, transformative education, which is really helping us to understand, like, what is this perspective that we live in? So it's like, you know, the metaphor that you use, which is beautiful, about the fog. Like, how do we learn that there's a fog there? You know, it's not any kind of education is going to teach us that. Some of it just reinforces the fog. So, you know, really having the kind of education, and like you said, it's not just formal. So there are some great teachers there who don't teach in any kind of school, but you will find them, and they're the ones who will just, you know, when you listen to them, you'll light up. It's like, oh, like this fog is lifting finally. So that they are folks who help us to really understand, like, there are so many assumptions that we live under. How can we just see those assumptions for what they are and open up all kinds of new possibilities for ourselves?
And, you know, it's interesting because I had a conversation just recently with my mentor from Phoenix, who we're going to have on this program this summer. And she was sharing with me how she's been trying to leave for the last 5 years. And I mean leave. Depart this earth. Okay? Now, she's not suicidal. Okay? She's perfectly, you know, in her right mind and so forth. But in essence, she's done all that she wants to do here. She's finished, you know. We get that way sometimes in a job. You know, it's not so much that there's no room for advancement, but, you know, I've seen where this is going, and I want to do more, and I can't really do more here. So I'm going to stop working here, and I'm going to go over here, or I'm going to become an entrepreneur, and I'm going to start my own business. That's like you did. And so forth. And I said, well, that's interesting. And I tell you what, when you do, I will not mourn your passing. I will celebrate the fact that you are now on the next step in this journey that we're all on. And she was actually quite pleased at that. And I may shed a tear or two because she was a good friend. She's shared so much with me over the years. She was actually my acting coach back in Phoenix. Not that I went into acting, but nonetheless, so there's an informal teacher, if you will, and my parents too. My parents, I don't see them as parents anymore; they're friends.
Yeah,
and which leads us to step two of your noble truths, that a relationship is everything, and that was something that was shared with me in a sales meeting once, and I never have ever considered myself a salesman. In spite of the fact that, as my father says, apparently I could sell ice cubes to Eskimos. I worked for a company here in Santa Barbara when we first moved here. I was there for about 9-10 months, and I made it to the upper levels of their sales team by virtue of my sales. But I hated the job in spite of the fact that I was so good at it. That was the irony of it all. But we do that all the time. But in a sales meeting, it was shared with me, what you're trying to do is establish a relationship. And I felt that that was sort of disingenuous. It's almost along the lines of under-promise to overproduce. That I'm going to establish this relationship with Maya so that I can get her to write me a check to support whatever it is that I want her to support. Instead of the relationship for the sake of the relationship. In other words, it's like there's always an agenda. And I thought,
right.
It just doesn't seem right. But I do understand the whole aspect, but I want you to describe from your perspective this aspect of relationship is everything.
Well, yeah, and I feel like what you just described is what I would call a transactional relationship, which is, to me, exactly what you say. Like, it's exploitive, it's disingenuous. So when I talk about relationship being everything, I don't mean that kind of relationship. I don't mean like, okay, I'm going to, you know, say that I value you because actually I want you to buy this thing from me. That to me is actually not even a relationship. I'm not sure what that is, but it's more of a transaction. So when I talk about relationship being everything, you know, I think I mean just realizing that the truth of the world is that we all depend on each other, and we depend on the plants that are growing outside and the air and the water. So relationship in that sense is like every day, even if we don't realize it, we are absolutely interdependent on, you know, all other beings and the earth that we walk on. And the more that we do realize that, the more we kind of live in a reality that just is grounded in gratitude, right? So it's not about, like, I'm going to get into this, you know, friendship with you because I want something from you. But it's just like we're already in a relationship, and how do we recognize that, and how do we really celebrate that generosity and have a, you know, I think reciprocity is very different from transactions. So, you know, we might genuinely want to support somebody, and then they support us back. And it's a very different feeling than like, okay, I'm going to do this so that you do this for me.
Yeah, I hear you. And that's one of the things, too, that as I said, I remember working for a radio station. I was actually hired. I was actually hired to be the program director. However, I was brought in on the first day as a salesman because they hadn't fired the current program director yet, which it didn't dawn on me until the second day. You do realize that if they do that to him, they can do that to you.
Right. Yeah.
But anyway, I was headed for my very first radio sale as a an official salesman for the station. And I get a phone call telling me, return to the station because, and of course it was that day that I was then put in the position. And fortunately the guy that I replaced was with, at least with me, he was good natured. He says, well, you had no control. I mean, you certainly could have quit, but you had no control over what was going on. So we remained friends, probably even to this day, as far as I know. But it's just really interesting the way and you used a word I have been trying to incorporate into the lexicon for the last few years. The current isms that are perpetuated around the world over and over again aren't working because eventually they fall apart. But you used a word that I use as an ism, interdependentism. And that is absolutely, from my perspective, We are interdependent on one another, which actually goes to number three. We're one, but we're not the same, and that's beautiful. And I'll add to that, we're also all connected, right?
Right. Yeah.
Talk to us about that.
Oh, what do you want me to talk to you about? That one, to me, it's just a little bit, it's kind of self-explanatory. You know, that we live in a world where there, and, you know, this is so up for us right now. You see it in the news all the time. Just, you know, really, we're on the edge of our differences. You know, there's people of color. There are white people. There's a conversation about that. There's looking at racism. And I think that especially in spiritual and liberal communities, there's this tendency to go to this place, oh, but, you know, we're all the same. And that's not exactly true, actually. And I feel like there's a lot of fear. Here we go back to that, you know, fear and anxiety that people have. And people get a little anxious around difference. It's like they need people to be the same. So I think this probably comes from a lot of my training in anthropology. I just really appreciate that we're actually not the same. I mean, on some fundamental level, yes, we are. You know, as human beings, we have, you know, biologically, there's a lot that's the same. Emotionally, we're feeling similar things, but our experiences are so very different, you know, in the way that each of us is raised in our cultures. And to me, that's actually something to celebrate. So it's not that we have to kind of blend everybody into the same mold, but that we can actually coexist. And we actually, you know, those differences really, that's what makes life to me worth living and really fascinating and vital, is the fact that we can be, you know, coexisting with somebody who has a completely different perspective on the same experience we're going through. And how about if we turn that into a place where we can actually, like, you know, learn from each other rather than, you know, put that other person aside, like, oh my gosh, who are they? Or try to bring them all the way to our side, like they have to see it like I do. So I just really feel like differences are actually a thing to celebrate, and that's, you know, and the whole, you know, talking about interdependence, like, again, that's, if you go into a natural ecosystem, like, you know, a forest, what you see are all kinds of organisms that are completely different from one another, but they live in a kind of symbiotic relationship and they support each other. So that's who we are as well.
Mm. You also talk in number four, story is powerful medicine. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, it's great that you're bringing these up. I haven't actually even looked at that part of my website for a long time. but each of us has a story, right? And mm-hmm. I think this is, it goes along with what we just talked about, that, you know, there, we have so many differences. We have places where we come together, but we also see things really differently. And I think story is a vehicle for each of us to share, you know, what our experience of being in this world is, depending on where we grew up, you know, the kind of family we grew up in, the ethnicity that we have. We have all that, you know, and there's maybe some pain and suffering that goes with that, but there's also a lot of really beautiful stuff that goes with each of our upbringings. And to actually be able to sit, you know, with one other person or sit in a circle of people and actually be able to share your story about how you experience your life. We don't get to do that very often, but when we do, if you've ever had that experience, it really is powerful. It's powerful for the person who's sharing their story, you know, to actually be listened to in a way that people are deeply hearing them. And for those who have the opportunity to witness that story, you also feel that as well. There's like some kind of healing that goes on. So that's the medicine part of it.
And I am in full agreement, especially considering the fact this program being Tell Me Your Story,
we're trying
to find that common ground that we all share in as far as the human experience. The final one has to do with reflection, and is that self-reflection, or is that sort of looking at the outside world as we see it, our perceptions? Well, what is that?
Well, it's both. I mean, I don't really make a big distinction between self and outside world. They actually flow together, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but it's, you know, reflection, just raising up the importance of having time to pause, to slow down. Again, in this world, we don't get a whole lot of that. We're just like, go, go, go. But we really need that. You know, we need cycles where we're in cycles of action and then cycles where we can step back and take an in-breath and just look and see, like, where have we been? What were the consequences of what we did? So reflection is really about both, like, you know, looking at ourselves and what's true for us and also, you know, in our world and what's the impact of the actions that we've taken.
Mm. You mentioned earlier about going a little Buddhist on us. You are a minister, is that correct?
I was ordained as a Zen Buddhist chaplain. So, yeah, I never do it, but I actually could use Reverend before my name, and that came from one of the gigs that I've had over the past 10 years. For 6 years, I was actually the director of a chaplaincy training program at Upaya Zen Center. And I went through the program myself, so that's where I got the ordination.
I'm curious as to why. Why was that important to you?
Well, that's a funny story because it kind of goes with the early on. I told you 2008. We were talking about, you know, the big economic kapooey that went mm-hmm. on and losing my job, and that's actually how I ended up in Santa Fe. And it was interesting. I mean, you talked about choice, and, you know, I'm going to reframe that again because I feel like the choice that I had back then was actually just to say yes to the universe. And it wasn't as though I planned to come to Santa Fe or do the things I was doing. It was more like, you know, I lived in the Bay Area. A lot of doors closed on me, and then that winter I came out here to Santa Fe and took a little vacation. I just had to get my head together. I came out here, I saw an old friend of mine, Roshi Joan Halifax, who founded the Upaya Zen Center, and she asked me how life was going. I said, oh, well, it's very interesting. Like, I don't know what I'm doing next. And that's where the opportunity opened. So she said to me, hey, I'm starting up this chaplaincy training program. I would love your help to get it off the ground. And so I said to her, yes, sure, I will do that. having absolutely no idea what chaplaincy even was. All I knew at that point was I needed some way to bring in a little bit of money, and it sounded interesting. I was like, okay. So the opportunity was to actually get the administrative end of the program up and running. And in the process of doing that, the first few years, I would watch people enter the program and go through it, and I really did learn what chaplaincy was, and it was really cool. And it was not anything I would have ever have thought of for myself before, but by virtue of this, wonderful synchronicity and, watching people go through it, I thought, oh, this is actually something I would love to do. And to me, I mean, I'll just give you my simplest definition of what a chaplain does. Basically, it's somebody who is able to accompany people through a period of suffering in their life and really help them find their own meaning in it, right? Mm-hmm. So, and most chaplains will work in settings like hospitals or police departments, so that's kind of traditional chaplaincy. But what I realized, by directing the program and then going through the course myself for 2 years, even if I never had a job with that title, because I actually didn't want to go back in and work in a hospital or anything like that, but that quality of, being that person who is kind of walking with somebody through their period of suffering, I mean, I bring that into my coaching. So, I think I'm kind of a stealth chaplain, basically. So, as I work with people in a coaching process and I hear what's going on for them, it's not my job to figure it out for them, but it's my job to accompany them and to help them find their own strength and meaning. So that's how I understand chaplaincy, and that's how I bring it into the work I do, even though I don't actually call myself a chaplain, if that makes any sense.
Sure. Let me ask you, from your perspective, what's the difference between philosophy of a Buddhist chaplain and where you are today philosophically?
I don't actually think there's any difference. I mean, I think that is, the kind of orientation that I bring to my work. So the Buddhist part is just, like we talked about earlier, it's just really having a deep understanding that freedom comes from inside. Happiness and freedom is something that we actually have the capacity inside of us to create and meet the conditions of the world. So that's the Buddhist part. And the chaplain part is, just knowing that I can listen to people and that they actually have it within themselves to find their answers. So I'm there to help create that space where they can do it. So I think in both senses, the Buddhist chaplain and what I do, it's actually the same philosophy that I'm bringing into my work.
Mm. Very interesting. I find everything about this fascinating because we are all just trying to find the answers to our questions. I love, for example, James Redfield in his book, Celestine Prophecy, where he talks about how we all have messages for one another. Mm-hmm. And that it really does behoove us to put those messages out there, because we will deny other people the ability to continue, sort of, as I look at it, completing our puzzle, our picture puzzle of the big picture, even though we may never actually finish it in this lifetime. But at least as we put more pieces in there, at least we get a better idea of that big picture, or at least glimpses, bits and pieces.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's why, to me, it's so important. You also talked about helping people who are suffering as a chaplain, but even today. There's a lot of suffering going on today. I mean, it's almost like a it's as monumental as what I used to hear back in the 70s when I was a kid growing up in high school. What do you want to do with your life? I want to change the world. Little huge, little, it's like, well, where the heck do you start? talk to me about this aspect of helping people through their own suffering.
Right. Well, and that brings it back to the book itself, because the book, to me, is one vehicle for doing that, because what I realized, and I realized this through my own experience of living and suffering a lot in, a lot of the jobs that I had, but, realizing that's actually a pretty common experience for a lot of people, that you know, we spend most of our waking hours at work, and unfortunately for a lot of people, it's a site of suffering. So the book is intended to be a way, you know, and when I do coaching with people based on the book, it's really a way to help people find their way out of that work-related suffering to something that's going to be much more joyful and fulfilling to them.
Oftentimes when a book is sent to me, there's a bookmark placed somewhere in the book, or the press release page is placed between a couple of pages. And I have never, ever considered that to be an accident. Matter of fact, the way I pronounce the word, there are no coincidences.
That's a good pronunciation.
So, in this book that I have, there is a little postcard from the publisher, and it happens to be in the midst of Chapter 8, and Think Big and Make the Most of Your Resources. Now, I'm going to put that in my own personal vernacular. I have, Maya, I have all of these tools that I have collected over the last almost 40 years of doing this. Why am I can't figure out how to put them to really good use, to really kind of rake in the money and do this and do that, you know, and do all the things that I want to do. So let's talk a little bit about that. I mean, I like to think I'm thinking big, getting a big old RV and traveling the world, doing interviews like this. That's pretty big. And yet this toolbox I've got, for some reason, I can't seem to figure out how to. I know how to use a hammer, but I'm not sure about all these other things.
Yeah, and I, you know, in that title for that key, Think Big, I explain in that chapter, because it's a little bit, you know, I think people can go astray on that one. Think Big doesn't necessarily mean huge, like you have to do something huge. But what the Think Big is more to relative to each person who reads this. So where is it that you're limiting yourself? You know, where are you kind of putting your own glass ceiling on something that you can actually break through that? And it may result in something that's actually quite small and humble. But if it's something that, you know, for you, you haven't been able to get to before, that is thinking big, thinking beyond your own limitations.
Hmm. Well, I know that for years when I was living in Phoenix, I wanted to move to the coast. Probably could have been the East Coast. I needed to be by the ocean. I did not expect to be living in Santa Barbara. Of course, I also didn't know what kind of expense it was to live on the coast of California. I know it's cheaper up the coast in Oregon and Washington, somewhat, at least for now. But here I am. And I remember getting sort of chided by this one woman who I would see every so often. And she would say to me, "Why are you still here? Why aren't you by the ocean? Isn't that where you wanted to be?" And I said, "Well, the universe hasn't opened up the doors yet." You know, and then eventually, of course, the universe opened up the doors. What about that aspect of waiting on the universe to open the doors for us?
I think that sometimes is what we have to do. I mean, I think the universe has its own timing. So sometimes we can have, you know, the right idea and the right opportunity, but other conditions in our life may not support that. So I think that is where it just, like, you know, that reflection element, being able to stop, just notice what the reality of our life is and the conditions around us, and we, you know, we can't always push through everything. There's that saying, like, don't push the river. So sometimes we try that and it backfires on us. I think there are things that are beyond our control and that we need to just, that's where, you know, having some kind of practice and learning patience for the process is really helpful.
Talk to us about the other part of that key, Chapter 8, as far as thinking big. What about that aspect of our own resources as far as making the most of your resources? Do we intuitively already know what they are, but we're out of fear or whatever other emotion we've generated or stories we've been telling ourselves or have been told over the years, that we don't see those resources? We don't believe that we have those things?
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes back to your great metaphor earlier about the fog that we, you know, often are living in. And I think when people hear the word resources, I mean, for me, this is certainly true for a long time. The first place we go is like, well, that means money, and I don't have enough, so I can't do this thing. So in the book, in that particular chapter, you know, I offer people an opportunity to, like, take an inventory of your resources and realize that that actually means much more than just financial. I mean, that's one of them. But there are also, you know, the life experiences that you've had, the skills, and some of them you may overlook because they just come so naturally to you. There's the people who are in your circles and your network. So there's all kinds of resources and assets that we have that I think are easily overlooked. So, yeah, so I think it's important for us to be able to have somebody prompt us to think about, oh, that's there, and I just totally forgot I had that.
Hmm. Well, I am always interested in trying to find answers, and that's why we do this program, to try to find answers to our questions as to why we are where we are at this point in time. And I've heard it said that you are where you are because of the choices that you have made in the past. Where do you want to be in the future? How do we go about the process of deciding where we want to be in terms of consciously deciding, not reacting, but I've heard this, the difference between this is reacting, and I've heard the word respond. You know, the other word, of course, don't react, act. But how do we make that leap? How do we get the fog to raise so that we actually know that we do have other choices? Is there a method, a step, an idea that you might have that can help us to do that so that we can say, I don't like where I'm at today. It's not terrible, but it could be better. I'd like to be, I don't know where I want to be tomorrow or in 10 years.
I'd say read the book.
There you go.
Yeah. And actually, I have another interview that's coming up in just like a minute, so I am going to have to wrap up. I just wanted to note that, Richard. But yeah, the book, I to me, it's like the going through the process of working through those six keys, that is the way to be able to kind of cut down on the sense of overwhelm or just not knowing what to do next. It's just, you know, begin working through a kind of framework that will support you to get more clear on your internal values, your core intention, and then get some very practical strategies in place to help you move towards what begins to grow as your vision for work that you can love.
I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program and remind our listeners the website is mayadur.com. MAIADURR.com. And before we let you go, two things. One, I'd like to invite you, should you find yourself here on the Central Coast, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation. And two, I have three final quick questions for you. And again, thank you so much for giving us so much time here on the program. First question is, who is Maya Dorn?
Who am I? I feel like I just thought of the Walt Whitman quote. I am multitudes. So, but I, you know, for what I do for a living right now, I do consulting, I do coaching, and I'm a writer.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I really hope that, you know, the book and the coaching that I do does help people to liberate themselves from any suffering that they have in their work and be able to find more joy and meaning in their work.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
For me, it's about being able to open up people's minds and hearts to new perspectives and new ways of being in the world.
Again, thank you so much for being with us here on the program and sharing with us this particular book that you've put out, Work That Matters, Create a Livelihood That Reflects Your Core Intention. And again, Maya, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Richard. Take care.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love Talal.